Well, good day and welcome to another episode here of the Disaster Podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, and it's always fantastic to have you all joining us here. And I want to thank you all for checking out another episode here of the show. I also want to welcome back the editor of my books and a fantastic editor at that, as well as my co-host, Sam Bradley. Sam, how you doing?
I'm doing good, Jamie. And I got to tell you, people, if you haven't read the first two of the series, when you get to the third one, it's a mind blower. I didn't do anything for like 2 days, but go through that book. It was just fascinating. So you're missing out. You're missing a treat if you haven't read that series of books yet. Available on Amazon.
Yes.
And you and Dr. Joe have both been traveling all over the place. We've had a hard time getting together. You got down to New Orleans and got to see BJ. I want to hear about that.
Our friend Dr. BJ Joe, Schneider from another author picked me up at the airport, and we hung out for a little bit, and that was nice. And so that was good. And I know, Joe, you were traveling.
Yes. Hi, guys. I just got back from Minneapolis. Another couple of days on CPR research up there. Some pretty cool stuff happening, as we talked about before. And then back in town for a little while now. So glad to be here.
Good. Well, we're going to have something we haven't done for a while. We'll have a little potpourri night because there's a bunch of interesting little things going on. Starting with, of course, our weather stories, which it falls on you, Jamie, because it seems like a lot of that's hitting the East Coast. We had a bit of a tornado. I saw some photos from the Weather Channel that came up far east part of Colorado kind of borders Tornado Alley, so sometimes we get some things in there, but we'll talk about that a bit. And then we have some listener questions that are really good ones that I want to address, and then we have a couple other topics that we'll surprise you with that we talked about, so there you go.
Yeah, well, we can kick off with talking about Tropical Storm Bonnie, which was the second named storm of the season. And we have to the caveat to add to this is the second named storm of the season, and the official hurricane season does not start until June 1st. We're actually recording this on May 31st. So it's very unusual to have storms this early in the season. The first one, if you recall, was back in January when there was an Atlantic hurricane that went past Bermuda and then spun over into Europe. It still had a lot of tropical moisture with it and dumped just a ton of rain and snow on Europe in January. So that was going on. But this one just is an interesting lesson for us. We've talked a lot about not underestimating the force of a storm just because it's not a level 4 or 5 hurricane or whatever. And this was a tropical storm. When it hit land, it actually had been downgraded to a tropical depression, and a lot of people might not have thought that was a big deal. You'd have some rip currents and some things like that, usually associated with that type of storm off the coast. But what really blew people away was that it slowed down to moving only at 3 miles an hour. And one of the weather people I saw actually made a comment that you could walk out from under this storm. If you went at a brisk walk, you could walk out from under this storm. It was moving that slow. And, of course, the problem with something raining, dumping that kind of rain and moving that slow, was really a lot of flooding that people weren't expecting right around Memorial Day weekend, and just dumped a ton of this rain on them and actually flooded in portions of I-95 in South Carolina, which I've driven on before. That road sits up well above the land around it. I mean, it's built to be kind of floodproof, and they had a foot of water on sections of 95 and had to shut the road down. So I-95 is the main Carter interstate that runs north-south on the East Coast, and it was shut down in portions of it because of this storm, all because it was moving so slow and dumping so much water. So, again, you have to really pay attention and be prepared, because anything can happen. You can't just judge, well, it's going to have winds in this storm force. Well, that's not strong enough to worry about. Well, in this case, there were other things to worry about, and I think that's a lesson learned here.
It is, because it isn't always about the wind, which does its own share of damage, but, you know, the slow ones, like you were saying, they can bring torrential rains, and you know, even though there was a lot of preparation in this case, well, look at Katrina, you know, how many... how many safeguards were there that they thought were impenetrable that didn't, you know, keep the water out. So, yeah, you always have to be aware. And, you know, speaking of water, our friend Kevin in Texas sent us an interesting, actually it came with a picture of the torrential floodwaters and these folks watching the water come down. And some kid fell in, went through a pipe, and they found him like 3 miles later and actually were able to get him out, thankfully. But that was pretty scary. So I guess Texas has taken a hit still.
Yeah, and well, maybe we can talk about that in the next episode a little bit as a story for that episode, because there's a ton of stuff going on. Even today as we record this, Texas just got slammed again with more downpours. I think the Brazos River passes through Houston, is cresting at 53 feet above flood stage.
Oh, my God.
The previous record was 50 feet.
Whoa.
So it's a new record for the flood stage, and they're just having all kinds of issues there. So we'll talk about that in the next episode a little bit.
Joe, are you getting anything down in Memphis right now?
You know, we've had a few springtime showers and thunderstorms and that sort of stuff, but nothing really significant. It's actually been quite a beautiful holiday weekend.
Well, good. I'm glad to hear that. Well, I want to go to our first question from Angelica here, and it's something we've kind of talked about before, but she was talking about evaluating if medical mission is legitimate in terms of, she's a PA in an ER and wants to do volunteer medical missions and really go into some austere area for a couple weeks, and was actually looking at sightseeing safaris and things. She'd like to go to Africa, but that's not what we're talking about, and it made me realize there's a difference between medical missions and disaster work, and we talked about both of those kinds of things. Medical missions, we've talked with Trek Medics. We had a great, I don't know if we put that up yet, Jimmy, but if not.
Yep, it's been up. It was a two-part episode a couple weeks ago.
That's right, we did. Jason was awesome and really kind of explained what they do and how they got started. And they're all over the world now doing stuff. And I think that's exactly the kind of thing she's interested in. So that's the type of organization you want to get involved with, or NGOs, non-governmental organizations, or faith-based organizations. I've mentioned a number of times there's folks in my DMAT that have regular groups that go to Haiti and all different, El Salvador, all kinds of different places, regularly a couple times a year to treat people that don't have any other form of medical care. So it's a regular thing that they do, and you can kind of plan ahead on it, unlike a disaster. When it comes to a disaster, you need to be on a specific team. We've talked to people that have gone out there on their own, and that's pretty scary because you don't know what you're getting into, especially in a foreign country. But there's kind of a difference there. But we'll talk a little bit more about that. And then, Joe, I want you to address her other question, which has to do with ER hospitals doing disaster drills. And I'm sure hers is not the only one where they're running into issues of getting people available for training because it costs money to get people out of the ER. And, of course, you can't pull your regular ER staff out of there. So I'd like your take on that. So do you have any thoughts, first of all, on the medical mission question?
Well, yeah. I mean, my first thought is to make certain in both the medical mission world and the disaster response world is to make sure that you are working with legitimate organizations that have a track record and have the infrastructure in place to take care of you and get you out of there and support you while you're there. You know, I think there's an awful lot of good meaning folks that put themselves in pretty precarious situations and probably don't do nearly the good that they could if they had been with an entity that could take care of the administrative side of things and the other issues that only come from experience.
Exactly. And I think safety is the key word here. And I think back to LN and having had that conversation with her, and she just happened to be you know, on vacation when Hyann came in and just found herself, she was just the kind of person that wanted to be helpful. And so she jumped in with whomever, you know, to kind of help out, which gave her the interest in getting more training. And she did it the right way. And actually, she's the one that first addressed this question, you know, how do I get the training? What kind of training do I get? What kind of organization should I could hook up with? But recognizing that that was the best way to go. So I absolutely agree. It's a real safety issue because you don't know what, if you can even, first of all, you have to be able to get there. You know, a medical mission is different because it's kind of normal operating procedure and the medical infrastructure is there. But, you know, just getting into country and saying, hey, I'm here, I'm going to do some medical care for you. Really? Well, how's that going to work?
And there's actually, I think, some things beyond that is who's, what about the medical legal issues associated
exactly.
with the given country? And these are all things that if you're going with a well-established organization where they have built a relationship with the local health department or government services agency that manages licensure or, you know, people coming in from other countries and doing medical care, you need to make sure that you're protected for doing the type of job that you're trained to do in another country. And there are some things that can come, you know, that can come back and bite you if you're not adequately prepared. So I think Joe's directly on track with his comment about there being a track record for this organization. What other trips have they been on? Have they been to this location before? Is this an area where they've had they do regular trips, so they go every year or maybe a couple times a year or every other year, so that they know what to expect and that the people in that location know what to expect from them. And so all these things make your trip, I think, a lot smoother when you go on that. I mean, heck, I've been on mission trips with my church here in the United States where that type of thing can be an issue, you know, just doing, you know, fixing wheelchair ramps and things like that, you know, over a week in the summertime. You don't know what regulations and zoning laws there are to deal with, and that's here in the United States. Imagine going to a foreign country and trying to do medical work and dealing with the fact that maybe you have not had the proper paperwork processed to do that.
Exactly. So you've got cultural issues, you've got political issues. I know when we went to Ukraine on a mission, we could take stuff in, but we couldn't, as much as we wanted to give a lot of the stuff to them, they weren't going to allow us to do that. We had to make sure we packed all the medical equipment out that we brought in. And these are just things you wouldn't know. But these organizations that have already, and the thing is, they've created a relationship with these folks in this particular country, and they probably have created a positive relationship because they are following the rules that this country has, like I said, culturally, politically. And I think the cultural piece of this is important too. You need to understand a lot about how to interact with folks in different countries. It's, you can do the wrong thing and meaning well and really get yourself in trouble. Have you run across that, Joe? And with your USAR work?
Yeah, sorry, I couldn't find the mute button. Yeah, I mean, we've seen exactly the same kind of thing. And I think that, you know, that's just goes back to the point we were just making with the need for established infrastructure, pathways, support, and not sort of winging it. Those are just not places to wing it at all.
Yeah, absolutely agree, Joe. I think that's 100% on target. And we've talked about this, you know, not freelancing, you know, when there's a disaster. And we talk about this with local response to, you know, even low-level calls or lower level than major disaster calls where, you know, you don't freelance and show up in your gear to another company's fire ground. You just don't do it. But there have been issues with that in the past in other places, and so we talk about it. Well, the same thing goes here. You can't just show up at somebody else's disaster without being invited, without being properly prepared and vetted up front. And that goes the same way for medical missions as well.
So there's also the fact that, you know, you and I, Joe, working for government organizations, federal government organizations, but, you know, we, up until, I don't know, a couple years ago when we started having these huge overseas disasters, Haiti being the one of most interest, we never thought, I mean, I remember that well, as you probably did, where all of a sudden we're being asked for our passports, and it's like, what? You know, we never considered ourselves an organization that was going to go out of the country other than the American protectorates and do this kind of thing. So that was a whole wild change in our environment. Now that's becoming more and more common with us. So even with us, we have to learn differences in cultures and things and kind of know what we can say and what we shouldn't say. And, you know, that's all part of the training that we need to do before we run off into some foreign country somewhere. So I'm sure you guys have had that experience. And we talked a bit about that. So, Joe, the other question I thought was really interesting, and I'm sure it's of interest to anybody that works in an ER, and I think a lot of our listeners probably do, about disaster drills. And there's a couple questions that I have behind this, but they're talking about the fact, and gee, this is not news, ERs always are full, and they're short-staffed, and they don't have a lot of extra people to go out and do anything other than take care of patients, but yet they're expected to have training in decon and mass casualty and disaster in general, and they don't usually have the money to pay people to come in on their off time or have agencies come in and do the training and that kind of thing, which, of course, you and Paragon could certainly do. But I know in California, I think it was a function of finding some funding, and we use what we call UASI funding for Urban Shield, which is a huge exercise we have every year for tactical medicine. We actually created, I think, took the basic hazmat decon operations course that we use for pre-hospital and developed a model for hospitals. So we actually train people in, you know, level B and I think even level A. And they were, when they bought the equipment available at the hospital, so at least a couple of people could engage with folks coming in that weren't completely decontaminated and that kind of thing. That takes a lot of money, so I appreciate her questions about time, but I think this funding allowed them to pay for the folks coming into training. And I think part of the thing was in that particular county, it was a requirement for all hospitals to have this level of training, to have certain pieces of equipment, to have decon showers and that kind of thing. And I don't know how universal this is. And Jamie, you can speak to this too. I don't know how much you know about what they do on the East Coast, but you know, if they're going to require it, then somebody's got to pay for it.
Well, they require, to my knowledge, they require a certain level of things at certain size hospitals. And so they might have decon showers, you know, packed up in a corner somewhere in a garage or a shed. But I know that to be true, at least at two different local hospitals. But there isn't the funding to train on it. So there might be funding for you to purchase the equipment needed to do decontamination showers and you know, a triage tent or something like that. For your facility in a major event, but then there's no funding to train on the equipment. So does anybody know how to set the tent up? Does anybody know how to actually, is anybody actually hazmat trained in the facility? And that I think is where the ball gets dropped. I'm not sure what Joe's experience with this is, but that's been what little I know about it comes down to that.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And as you say that, I'm thinking it was that county only has level two trauma centers, but those were the ones that, especially the one big level two trauma center, was the one that had the higher expectation. And I think maybe with the community hospitals, it was more a function of just having decon showers and having that availability. What do you think, Joe? This is really your area of expertise more so than ours.
Well, there's so many different issues here. You know, I think that many hospitals, of course, have someone who's in charge of, you know, emergency preparedness and all that sort of stuff. I worry that, you know, that's the person that comes in every time to help run the drill. And in reality, that's the only person that really has much of an understanding of what's really going on. And, you know, I know at some hospitals I've seen they've done things like bring in some off-duty staff and even bring in another physician during the, you know, scheduled disaster to run the disaster so that it, you know, it doesn't detract from their daily activities of taking care of patients in the emergency department. And I, you know, I think there's some value in that, but I also worry that it really doesn't test the system very well, and that those that are in charge and administering the hospital administrators, et cetera, just simply don't have a good understanding of what it is they're trying to test there and what the value of the exercise is. You know, if there's only one person in your facility that knows how to, you know, don and doff PPE for Ebola, then it really isn't doing you a lot of good to bring that person in to do it every time, because what happens when that person isn't there? I don't think they do a good job of sort of using it to find out areas where they're weak and then working hard to try to improve that capability amongst the rest of their employees, et cetera.
Well, the way we did it, and you made a point of this, is we had all of the county resources involved. The firefighters that were trained, and I was one of them at hazmat operations, were helping with the training. There was an exercise that went with it. Like I said, of course, you got to find funding for all of this, but every hospital, every ER employee was expected to go through this training. And, you know, it was trying, can't remember exactly what the time frame was, but to at least get a basic level of understanding. Not everybody was trained at the higher level of PPE. There were fewer of them. But then, like you said, Joe, what happens if you have that big hurricane and that person happens to be on vacation that week? So they have to have at least enough people. And then, of course, there's the issue of retraining those people if somebody like that leaves. You're right. It's not going to do much good. I think it works a lot better if you integrate your resources and, you know, how is fire going to pass off to the ambulance? How is the ambulance going to pass off to the ER? What's the ER going to do when they get these people? You know, there's a whole list of things that need to come together for it to have any real value. So I see your point on that.
I've certainly seen, you know, instances where the emergency management team at the hospital, you know, basically says, well, we would, at this point in our, you know, call our algorithm, we would call in extra staff. And, you know, nobody ever really pursues that a little bit farther and says, so how would you do that? Well, you know, we just pick up our phone and call them on their cell phones. Well, what if there are no cell phone towers working? Oh, well, we would send them an email. Well, what if that's not work? You know, I mean, down to it, you know, that they're so reliant on day-to-day conveniences and how we do things. And, you know, you just pick up your phone and you can take care of everything. That when that incredibly important piece of technology goes down, man, we're stuck in a lot of cases. And I think, until you really get to those situations, you don't really have a true test of what you would be able to do and how you'd be able to do it and the consequences associated with that, you know, including just saying to those folks, well, I tell you what, why don't you pick, you know, random person number 15 off this list and just give them a call right now and just see what happens. And see what response you get. And, you know, a third of the time it's like, well, I'll be right there, but, you know, I got to go get the kids at school and take them home and call my mom. And, you know, they suddenly begin to appreciate, wow, it's going to take hours for that person to get here. So, you know, they make an awful lot of assumptions, I think, that leave an awful lot of potential issues untouched.
Well, and you're right, and they don't know these problems exist until they fall over them. And I was lucky enough to be in the county that happened to find funding, but we would have, even though not often, the county would set up exercises. So virtually every element of who would be involved in a disaster. I mean, at the county level, and I was actually involved in the communications part during one of them, because like you were saying, you know, what if the ambulance can't talk to the fire department and the fire department can't talk to the ER? And, you know, communications is always a huge piece of these things at every level. That's just one thing. Then you're, you know, are you going to have ambulance strike teams? How are you going to get all these people out there to, you know, to get folks to the ER without, you know, crippling the existing system? There's just so many moving parts to this thing that to be done really well, it can't be just the ER. This is just a piece of what we're doing, but it just works so much better when you have all the different elements, because you don't realize what doesn't work until you try it and go, whoa, wait a minute. we don't have a common frequency here. Now what are we going to do? So, I mean, that's pie in the sky pretty much. It's well above and beyond her question. But I think really what it is maybe your county agency needs to look at what funding is available out there from the federal government and other resources for disaster training. Maybe that's something they can tap into.
Oh, I think that's definitely not a bad idea. I mean, you know, funding is always an issue, but I think in many cases it doesn't take a lot of money to test out some really, really basic systems like a call tree and come to quickly appreciate sort of what the issues might be, just so that you're aware that this is likely to happen. And therefore you can plan for it moving forward when you do actually have real money and can do a real exercise. You can incorporate those things into that real exercise and be ready to respond to them.
And of course they can always call Paragon, because you guys can create just about any kind of training everybody needs, eh?
Well, we're certainly happy to help them do that, and glad to you know, assist with that. We like to think that we have the ability to pull those things off and make it pretty realistic for folks. So, you know, I think that there's a real advantage to that, but there's also an awful lot that hospitals can do with minimal resources and minimal time commitment.
Yeah, well, tabletop planning, there's all kinds of things that
right,
you can do without having a full-blown drill and pull, you know, different sections of the staff together and run the same drill, you know, tabletop exercise. At least that would get their brains thinking in the right direction, which is, I think, Joe, isn't that really half the battle?
Absolutely. You're exactly right. Just recognizing some of the things that could be an issue is a huge part of it.
Wow. Well, I hope that helps answer her question. We'll put that up on the website as well. But I really wanted to get some thoughts from you, Joe, before I tried to answer that question. But, you know, it sort of stimulates. It's like you answer one question and it brings up 30 more. So
no,
it really.
Nice.
And I have no idea what part of the country she's in or anything. So I don't know what kind of resources they may have locally. But anyway, food for thought. I would guess, Joe, if they have questions like that, they could contact you guys at Paragon. And you could certainly give them some advice on just some of the things you were just saying about, hey, well, what about a tabletop that doesn't cost as much money and it could be done on a slow day in the ER or whatever. So,
sure.
You know, maybe you can help them out or contact us on the website.
Yeah, absolutely.
Where can folks find Paragon online, Joe?
Well, our new website is at paragonmedicalgroup.com. You can find us on Facebook under the same name, and our Twitter feed is paragonmededu.
And check out the new website, folks. Go over there and visit it. There's some great resources available there, great video that kind of explains what's going on. And take advantage of the resources they have. You know, one of the things that we really love about being associated with Paragon and Joe and Jim and the rest of the team is just how passionate they are about making sure people are educated and prepared, at least as prepared as you can be for a disaster event. And you can't go wrong contacting them. And Joe, thanks again for your continued support here at the Disaster Podcast.
Oh, absolutely. My pleasure.
So, Sam, we've answered Angelica's question, and, you know, I think as we wrap up here and give our contact information, you know, we just want to urge other people, send their questions into us. There's a contact form on the website, or you can just leave a comment at the bottom of any of the episodes, And that will send an email to me right away when you leave that comment. And I can go ahead and read it and start sending word out to get some people to come in and answer it for you. So, you know, either way, we will get back to you and get you an answer, either by email, by comment, or maybe, just like with Angelica, here on the show. Sam, where can folks find you if they want to reach out to you in other places?
Well, the usual social media places, Facebook and LinkedIn and Twitter and everywhere else under Sam Bradley or Sam Bradley 11, pretty much. And certainly on the Disaster Podcast website. And like Jamie, I love these kinds of questions. It really stimulates our thinking and actually might give us a good topic for a whole episode. So if you have some ideas we haven't touched on yet, or even if we have, there's always a new take on them. So please do get a hold of us. What about you, Jamie?
Well, you can find me under the handle PodMedic in most places out there, so PodMedic. Of course, all of the shows I work and associated with are available for linked from MedicCast.com. But most importantly, for all you disaster heads out there, just head over to DisasterPodcast.com. Check out all of the episodes. It comes out every Thursday. We love to make sure that we cover a variety of topics, and we've really covered a lot of different things having to do with disaster response, preparedness, austere medicine, wilderness topics, mountain topics. You know, I mean, we've really tried to cover a wide gamut of things having to do with being prepared for that, you know, unforeseen event wherever you may find yourself. And, you know, this is another example. You know, if you're preparing for a disaster drill in your hospital, you really don't understand, if you don't have an opportunity to do that training, what disaster medicine is.
Oh, that's the truth. That's just another example, Jamie, that disaster medicine is not our everyday medicine.